Hello and welcome back to the Building HVAC Science Podcast. I think you know by now, if you've listened to a few episodes, it's our goal here at Building HVAC Science to help create better, more knowledgeable HVAC and building performance technicians by helping these two professions better understand each other with the ultimate goal, making customers happy in the homes they live in and the buildings they work in. In this episode, this is another one of those that came from a thought, an idea, something I read on LinkedIn. A gentleman named Jesse Smith wrote an article for Asterisk magazine called Lies, Damn Lies, and Manometer Readings. Now, how more attractive can that be to a building science nerd like nerds like myself, Eric Kaiser, and I? Jesse will tell us about his experience, this podcast, and challenges in the HVAC field. And this all came through his journey from working in carpentry to specializing in high-performance buildings and energy retrofits. We delve into the concerns Jesse has about construction, the HVAC industry, stagnation in productivity and innovation since the 70s. And he, like many others, call for better education and accountability in this industry to overcome these challenges. Jesse's perspective is that coming from an insider, he's calling for systemic change, advocating the adoption of better practices and technologies to improve building performance and ultimately contribute positively to societal health and environmental goals. Big heady words there, but Jesse's a really down-to-earth person. I think you'll enjoy this interview that Eric and I have with Jesse Smith.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Building HVAC Science Podcast with Bill Spohn and Eric Kaiser. Today, we've got a very special guest that I'm very excited for. Bill and I picked up on an article that he wrote in Asterisk magazine or asterixmag.com, and it's Jesse Smith. And Jesse wrote an article called Lies, Damned Lies, and Manometer Readings. And I am very interested to dig into more of this. So welcome, Jesse, to the show.
Thank you, guys. Thanks.
Thanks. When you say manometer around the wrong crowd, you're going to get this kind of reaction. So this is your own fault. Give us your backstory. What brings you up to the point of writing this article? What's the background behind that?
So it's complicated, but I was a carpenter for probably many years, mostly working around Princeton. My brother and I have a business together that we started around 2000, and we were just working in that market, doing pretty standard stuff, remodeling. I was really interested in high performance buildings going back a really long way. Even my dad was probably like early to the 70s, high energy efficiency, double stud walls in the 70s and 80s even. I just had a background in this stuff, was really interested. And around the time of the housing bubble, started dabbling in energy retrofits, and transitioning from high performance buildings, construction dried up into more home performance with Energy Star in New Jersey was a very popular program. We started working in that, getting training for it around 2009. And so gradually, partly through exposure to subcontractors and partly through attending classes and learning more and more, I just progressively got sucked into the world of HVAC.
So that's a great backstory and very interesting how it led you there. And the home performance with Energy Star, did you get introduced to blower doors? Is that where the word manometer came up, maybe? Am I guessing?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So first, I think that was a pretty typical pathway around 2009. You take a class, you get the BPI analyst envelope certification, and then onto the heating and then AC heat pump. Yeah, so running blower doors, still doing that quite a bit. We've done the shell side of probably around 2,000 energy retrofits on the shell side. So we have a couple of dedicated trucks for just insulation, weatherization, that kind of stuff. But then also picking up, at least with me personally, picking up on the HVAC side, probably starting first with like design.
So how much do you get into HVAC now? Are you doing full system retrofits, duct systems, the whole nine yards? Is that an integral part of your company currently, or do you just do it for the houses that you work on?
So for the houses where we remodel, we do that stuff in-house. But it tends to be people who are interested in electrification. So a lot of mini splits, and not high volume, like to be really clear, not high volume, but we do have that stuff in-house. We do duct installation, the whole package, I guess.
Very nice. So what is your core business that leads you into this? And I'm guessing that probably there was some comfort concerns coming from your customers that really led you down this road. And some of the points you made in your article, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of resonating here from a lot of sides. It's kind of exciting to me hearing somebody in construction and a builder talk about this, because that's typically not what we get from carpenters and people that build the houses. They just want to make everything look pretty and then run away. It's the feeling that I get a lot of times.
Yeah. So I was interested, and I'll tell you the one anecdote from the article. People could check out the article at asteriskmag.com. So I was taking those classes, but also just insanely green, the greenest, most naive guy you've ever met in your entire life. One of the really pivotal moments was what I described in the article was we've done the insulation side of somebody's house and stuff just doesn't feel right. I think it was even that I was just testing the tools maybe. Like, so I had a flow grid. I thought flow grids were like amazing. Like I thought they were the coolest tool like ever. So like I had no practical experience outside the training class, I think at this point. And so I'm like, okay, cool. I'll just stick this in here. And I knew the outdoor unit was like 3 tons. So like in my mind, 1200 CFM exactly right or whatever. And I drill the holes and set it all up and I stick it in and it's like 2000 CFM. And I was like, oh, that seems weird, but I probably did something really wrong. So I actually re-drilled the holes, like without any real understanding of even what the holes are doing. Like I'm just following the instructions from the Energy Conservatory and plugging this in. And I get as close to the exact same number by restaging the test. And so I'm sitting in this person's basement for no reason. There's no reason really for me to be doing this, I don't think, other than like I want to get time on the tools. And I'm reading the manual and I'm reading about dip switches and not fully understanding, but eventually I find the dip switches and they're all in the off position, which anybody who knows anything now is, okay, cool, that nobody set dip switches. And I called the technician who I knew, we're friends. And he says, you don't have to do that. I said, the dip switches, they're in the same position. Like, did you set airflow? He goes, you don't have to, it knows. And I said, are you sure? And I was really uncertain. And he goes, yeah, it knows. Like you just plug it in and it knows. And understand, like we're not talking communicating stuff here. We're talking a 20-year-old outdoor unit that we've just matched a new furnace to. And I remember being like, this does not feel right. And eventually I reset dip switches and reran flow grid and had airflow in the 1200 range. But this led me on this thing where my guess is maybe in excess of 90% of furnace AC matches just do not have, they're just stuck in default. And it led to the cruxy bit of the article, which is that endemic HVAC incompetence is really damaging to society and sits at the crux of two catastrophic risks to humanity, one being pandemic prevention via indoor air quality, and then the other being global warming. So we're really at the crux of those two points, and we're not doing very well. And it's also completely overlooked. And this led into a lot of my thinking about the pandemic and what I ended up working on through there. But anyway, sorry, hopefully that clarifies things.
When did you publish this article? When did it first appear?
I think maybe last month, quite recently. I actually wrote a forum post on the Effective Altruist forum about this and had decent feedback on that. And they approached me, Asterix Mag reached out to me after they read the forum post.
Any other reactions? Any other invitations to podcasts? We're jealous. But
no, this is my first ever podcast. So oh, wow. Super exciting.
Wow. We broke you in right here.
Exactly. This is amazing. I like it. I get to talk with the titans of industry. I've followed you guys for a while. Yeah. You had Joseph Allen on.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really cool stuff.
A lot of the things you said in here and a lot of the conclusions you reached are actually very much in parallel to where other people in the industry are going. And that was one of the things that fascinated me about what you wrote down here was that you reached these conclusions in a completely different way. So it really reinforced to me like a lot of the things we're seeing happen in the industry today and we're realizing about the industry. And this has been heading this way over the past, I'll say, 5 to 8 years. It's in my time in the industry, I've really started to see this realization growing that, hey, we're not doing these things right out here. And there's people now that are starting to point this out and try to move the industry in a better direction.
Yeah, that is a multifactorial type of problem. But I agree. I think I'm one of the guys who's probably not pulling punches. I maybe don't have as much to lose. So like, not a lot of people are saying that endemic incompetence, they're not using the framework of endemic incompetence. I'm just coming right out and saying it. Like, people can come at me about it. But yeah, but it's complicated because you have situations that could be addressed by more effectively by manufacturers. For instance, the pace of technological change isn't so great. And it seems like there are a lot of opportunities to fix things where we should be going a little bit faster. Like, I think rapid lock system is probably an example of that. Yeah, it's complicated. Like, I wouldn't put it all on technicians, say. But what I'm saying is there's a deficit, like a failure to meet the demands that basically should be met, however you want to put that.
Do you think this leads to consumers not getting what they're expecting or maybe paying for in some of these situations? Is that heading down that road, or where do you think this goes to in the end?
Yes. So very strongly, I believe that to be the case. I sort of view this across this backdrop other problem where a lot of people in the industry don't realize this, but the construction industry in the United States has had no economic growth since the 1970s. You could go on NBER and check out Austin Goolsbee has a fairly recent paper, maybe like a year ago. This is really bad. If you aren't following economics that closely, you can't have entire segments of an economy not experience productivity gain. Other sectors, their productivity gain is probably at least mid-single digits. By anybody's measuring, the United States construction industry has experienced no productivity growth since the 1970s. Like, since I was born, basically. This is a really big deal. And to some extent, it indicates broad problems, but I think there's an HVAC contribution potentially here. I don't have super strong feelings about it, but yes. So essentially, people buying construction services are being robbed of productivity growth generally. And then I think HVAC as a microcosm of that is even slightly worse.
So we've had Eric and I, and you know, through our business and our interactions over the years, have had the benefit of seeing what we think is great strides in productivity, but it sounds like it's not getting out there to the masses. Do you have any idea why?
No, I don't think anybody does.
Okay, we're done talking now. I wanted an answer here.
I think broadly in construction, there have been several hypotheses that have been ruled out, I think. So capital investment isn't one of them, or doesn't appear to be one of them. It's a difficult problem. And here again, I'm speaking broadly. Nobody's really looking at, that I'm aware of, nobody's really looked at HVAC in isolation. But I do feel that more people in positions of authority in various subtrades should be keyed into this. This is a really big deal. Think of economic growth since the 1970s and then think, okay, construction as an industry has experienced none of that. How different was your life in the 1970s? Pretty significantly different. The economy is probably, maybe we're 5X by now, not construction.
That's an interesting take. I'm going to have to go read more stuff. Thank you.
I will send you some links.
Here comes a rabbit hole.
Yeah. Here comes another rabbit hole.
So go on the NBER website and Austin Goolsbee, and I think you can get a pre-published draft of his paper on this. It's excellent. Really worth checking out.
So you tie back into IAQ and the pandemic, and what's your take around best practices there? If it were an ideal world, what should be happening?
I think that this problem that I described is the lens through which to approach this. And I think that was just completely missed. So when I was ranting about this being the primary obstacle in, say, spring, summer of 2020, there was no traction. People would say things like, oh, well, yes, we're going to have to do training. Okay, so I'm going to generalize. But with hindsight, what appears to have happened with the pandemic is no social interventions were effective really at all beyond marginally, aside from a program to get people vaccinated. So the vaccines probably saved in the United States, maybe 400,000 lives. Indoor air quality interventions did, I don't know, probably close to nothing. In the grand scheme of saving 400,000 American lives, what did we do with indoor air quality? Almost nothing. And that's not like we could not have. So the One Day Sooner, which is an organization that's its effective altruist as well, did a fairly recent report, and I can send you the link for this too, that estimated, it was pretty broad, but they said, okay, under ideal conditions, had we had indoor air quality measures to a level that we would want, we would have reduced transmission by, they estimated, 30 to 70%. So it's very, very significant. Yeah, very significant. And look, like Shelley Miller, right? An engineer, I forget, she maybe at Colorado.
Yes, Colorado.
Right. So she ran this really good study of really weak depressurization of isolation wards and found that it cut transmission to, in her case, it was literally nothing. I think at scale, it probably wouldn't be at that level. But she was depressurizing isolation rooms to like negative 2.4, I think.
Pascals.
Yeah, Pascals. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, negative 2.4 Pascals with reference to the hallway, I think was her study. Then she had no transmission between isolation rooms. My wife is a doctor. She works in long-term care facilities. They would get a case and it would just pop all the way down the hallway and people died and it happened all the time. And this is a year into Shelley Miller's study. We knew what to do. And so we had no ability to deliver interventions that were effective. And I think as a consequence, probably we had a lot more deaths than we had to. And I really think that's probably, to some extent, that's on the HVAC industry. To some extent, I think it's on the people in public health roles not keying into this problem on the ground. So if you were ranting about this being an obstacle in 2020, there was no traction. Right now, hey, they hit their head against the wall for 3 years and they're coming around on it, right?
Yeah.
Right. But this is real. So I'm sorry. And then going to your question, what do? Well, you give people tools. I think the tools of doing this are probably the tools that I would say to my wife were going to become popular in June of 2020. Like I said, I remember saying to my wife, I was like, when the kids go back to school in September, there's just going to be a big CO2 monitor in every single classroom. You're going to go to a restaurant, there's going to be a CO2 monitor. The prediction I've most been wrong about in my life, and there are many, but that was really a big one. So I think giving people tools of indoor air quality is probably going the right. Air things are amazing. Their interfaces probably could be a lot better in terms of public buildings. But yeah, those types of tools, I think, are probably the direction. Sorry, that's a long answer.
No, that's great. It's awareness, education, what's it like, realization, relating it to your problem, investigation, and then some action.
Yes. And I think being a pain in the ass. I talk about in the article, so, and I'm sure you guys heard it too, right? We can't upgrade the filter in our school system that can't handle MERV 13. Okay, cool. Great. That's a dead end conversation for the great majority of people who aren't technical. But if you're a pain in the ass, you go, oh, okay, cool. Show me where you drilled the holes. Show me where I assume you took external static pressure. So just show me where you drilled the holes. Ah, there's no holes. Do you own a manometer? No. It says in the manual, like, okay, show me in the manual. So I think to some extent, people have to become acclimated to the norms around a culture that is, in cases like that, not fundamentally honest, and they're willing to just take it all the way.
We're really guessing without testing there.
Yeah, I would say. And I talk about it in the article. There was never an instance where I found that someone had done anything other than say they can't do it. And that was many, many cases. Universally, that's what's reported across the country. Like I was inundated with stuff on social media related to this. Someone would say, oh, the facilities person says they can't upgrade the filters to MERV 13. Okay.
Do you think this is like we just have a issue not knowing what to do or how to do it? Or do you think maybe there's an issue with people wanting to pay to do it? Or where do you think this all starts here?
I don't know. That's a crisis that seems to be a mix of malevolence and incompetence. You could just say, oh, I don't know how to do this, but and that would be fine. But you're also being like someone doing that, someone saying, oh, I can't do this. That was a weird claim. It's not unheard of, but I don't totally understand the psychology of the claim. It seems like the type of thing people will say when they really don't want to do something and they've had no accountability whatsoever for any previous claim that was deceptive. I'm going to get hate mail on that one. I can feel it.
We won't share your email address, or we'll just make one up. Do you see anything? You're doing something really tremendous from like your position in the world by bringing this topic up. So congratulations. It's not like you should be the focus for this discussion, but you are the focus for this particular discussion with us, at least. Do you see anything that's giving you some rays of hope, some change in process, some things that are different that perhaps you can spur some of our listeners to?
Sure. There are just some real kick-ass techs, and I definitely didn't give enough credit to that. There is this minority of technicians who, despite everything, just are crushing it. So you have that. And I don't know how to get that to percolate through, but you see examples of companies, you see examples of technicians. The backdrop isn't amazing. So I don't know how those technicians can be used to pull everybody up. You also see technological stuff. Like, I think we're probably going to technology our way out of a lot of problems. To some extent, it's surprising that we haven't already in some cases. Like, refrigerant leak is just a really big deal right now. And so I just think that's a problem we're just going to tech our way out of. I don't see a world in which, I mean, I could be totally wrong on this. If we're doing flare fittings in 20 years, that would be really weird to me. Do you guys feel the same way about this?
Things have moved along quite a bit in some areas. It's interesting to see where they're going. And I don't know if what we have now is the ultimate answer, but things change. I mean, you mentioned earlier the flow grid. Well, look what's happened with that, with the new digital true flow grid. That was a huge step forward in both ease and accuracy. So it'll be interesting to see where the technology goes. Going back to the indoor air quality, I'm really interested to see like a lot of the automation that's starting to happen, because we've had the first stage of, okay, we can start testing this, but what do we do with these readings? You mentioned some air quality monitors out there, and I think a lot of people got those results, but then didn't know what to do with it. Or if they needed to do something with it, they didn't know how to do it or what to do in the immediate. It wasn't an immediate action thing for them. Whereas a lot of that stuff now, we're starting to see those reactions automated. So it's something that just happens for us, like a thermostat turning on the heat or turning off the heat so that it keeps it at a comfortable point.
Yeah. So here we're talking about CO2 as a proxy and like demand-based ventilation based on CO2 levels, that kind of stuff.
With anything, CO2, PM2.5, there's all kinds of different things that are happening in the marketplace now.
I wanted to bring up a self-plug here for a movement that we started called Better HVAC. Have you seen anything on that yet?
I don't think I have, no.
Okay, betterhvac.org. It's been a term kicked around for a couple years by a number of people, sort of in the minority circle that you mentioned before. And there's three of us in a group that have decided to push it forward. And we launched it at the HVAC School Symposium back in February and got well over 100 people, maybe close to 120 people now that were calling themselves champions who want to do better and want to share best practices and want to communicate their betterness eventually to consumers. So consumers have a way of learning and finding people to do better work.
That sounds really promising.
Yeah, somebody's got to do it. Because it's all out there. Like you said, it's all out there. Like Eric said, there's a lot of technology out there. And it's not to say this has to be force fit into everyone's practice, but the awareness of it has to rise and to level up so that better work becomes an option. It becomes part of the vocabulary of their customers. Customers begin to ask for better work because they know about it. So consumer education is coming up to be a really huge component.
I agree with that very strongly. Consumer education seems like it should be a really big part of this. And we have all of the tools necessary to make everything transparent to everyone. So if you want to, whatever, you want to charge refrigerant, you should be able to document this in a way that people can understand at a consumer level and verify using software. I haven't seen that in widespread use, but I'd be very interested in seeing where that goes.
You familiar with MeasureQuick?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Okay, that's an approach there where there's a verifiable result that a report can be created, posted, transferred, that kind of thing.
Sorry, I'm not super up on MeasureQuick, but do they automate the consumer facing side?
Not yet. As far as I know, I think there's a report that can be delivered to consumers with the contractor branding on it, with scoring. This is something going back in my mind because I haven't touched it in a couple of years. Eric's might be more familiar with it. He attended a class last year on it. Isn't there like a consumer report with like a letter grade on it?
Yeah, there's a couple different consumer reports, but probably the most common one they have now is a consumer report with a letter grade on it that goes through a test to figure out how the system is performing, what it's doing, what the age is, all that kind of stuff. And that all factors into that letter grade. And then it spells out for the consumer like what parts of the system could be problematic and gives them an idea of maybe actions that they can take in the future, things like that.
So when you're ready to write that follow-up article, we can provide you with some resources.
We'll do a Measure Quick thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Measure Quick and a better HVAC thing. What the heck? Why not?
Yes. I do think that stuff is some of the most promising in like modern tech. I just think you get into difficulties, and I don't know for Measure Quick, but you get into difficulties because where you get widespread adoption and you get a lot of failures, people really pull back from the consumer facing side, right? Then you're okay. So does the consumer facing side of Measure Quick become a niche thing that a minority of people end up doing where it's like really easy? Or does it become the widespread thing that we all push to adopt and then gets quashed because the baseline of confidence isn't high enough to support it? And then also it could become a catalyst for potential change. And hopefully that's how it goes down. But you do see probably there's some history of manufacturers saying, oh, let's make a visible error code on the UI. And then they're just inundated, right? And the consumer goes, oh, I have all these error codes. What's going on? So they just say, okay, well, we're just not going to put error codes on the UI. That doesn't feel like a great solution, but it's probably where things tend to go.
Or like my heat pump water heater, the eco mode runs resistance.
Oh, is that right?
The resistance back. Okay, yeah. The eco mode runs it. You have to override to heat pump only to get the true benefit and really to be in eco mode. I have a stinking or a suspicion that it's because they got too many phone calls when truly in heat pump only mode for recovery time for high demand. But the consumer isn't given that choice. They're, I'll say, duped into thinking they're in eco mode when they're not really.
Yes, this type of thing comes up a lot. Why do we have dip switches default to the highest nominal tonnage supported by the drive? Well, it's because the manufacturer doesn't want to call back. Most likely, the manufacturer doesn't want to call, oh, this thing didn't come on. So the call that is, oh, I have essentially no latent capacity whatsoever, that call probably doesn't happen 9 times out of 10. So you still have something that functionally blows cold. It's just suboptimal. But I think the ultimate architecture for that is for everybody to understand it and say, okay, it's not going to turn on unless you set it up in a way that pushes you towards optimizing. Also, one other thing I'll say here is dip switches are just a nightmare. So I get it. I'm an old guy now. Like I just turned 50. This is actually a pain. And another thing that I think is, why are we doing this? I'm sure we could come up with, well, we have other systems, but it's just probably a question of cost on some level. But crawling around in the cabinet, looking at these tiny little switches seems suboptimal. That's another area I think we're going to tech our way out of.
I always have to take a picture of it because I can't read it even when it's like right in front of me and then zoom in the picture and decide where is that switch actually set.
Right. If I'm dropping my reading glasses all over the place, it's not a great system.
What's taking up your time now? What do you do besides write articles?
I don't have a ton of direct involvement, but I'm a co-owner with my brother of an exotic lumber store. We have a mill and a kiln. I have some involvement in that. So we do a lot of live edge slabs that we sell out of there to the public, to woodworkers, other things. Yeah. About the time I was transitioning from HVAC, I was also raced a lot of Ironman. This is like how I slacked off in my 20s and 30s, was raced Ironman a ton. And so I still run maybe in the range of maybe 45, 50 miles a week.
Wow.
It's not that much.
Eric took part in a, what was it called?
We did a half Ironman relay team last year.
Oh, nice. Which leg did you get?
I do the swim.
Oh, nice.
That was up in Massachusetts or Maine?
We went up to Maine and did it just before the building science summer camp at Joe Stiebrick's. We went up to Maine and then came back down to Boston to Stiebrick's place.
That water's cold up there, I bet, right?
wasn't bad, actually. There was actually a chance we weren't going to get to wear wetsuits, which I was going to be very bummed about because I sink like a rock.
What's the threshold for that? 70 or something?
Yeah, it's like 73 or 74 degree water, something like that is the threshold. And they had a bunch of rain the night before, so it dropped the – it was in a river. It was a downriver swim. So
not bad.
It was fast. I did 22 minutes for 1.2.
Yeah, that's decent. That's cooking, right? Nice.
Oh, yeah, that was fast.
Yeah, I think my fastest Ironman time was current assisted as well. So something.
Wow.
Yeah, super fast. Yeah, you got lucky some days. Some days, not so much. But there was always a thing where people would say that Ironman Corporation would drop a thermometer to the bottom of a lake before they'd let a few thousand people without flotation devices, i.e. wetsuits, into the water. I think they're really hesitant to let people into the water without wetsuits, but I could be wrong. I don't know if it's changed since I raced. It's been a long time.
I don't know where they measured it at, but I was happy to have that wetsuit on.
Definitely. You just got to pick up the bike and the run. You'll be set.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to do that. We had a lot of fun doing the relay team. I might do some shorter ones here locally, some of like sprint triathlons or something, but I'm not going to do a whole half Ironman by myself anytime soon.
Yeah, they're fun.
I work too much. I don't have time to train that much.
Ah, you can fake it.
Yeah.
Stuff. Not, you can't fake Ironman, but you can fake a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you can't fake an Ironman. That's, yeah.
In closing, for our listeners, we'll definitely put the link to the article in there. Anything else we should link to or anything else we should highlight for listeners to follow up on?
My brother runs a really mean Instagram page for our store. If you want to check that out, Willard Brothers.
Sure.
I don't do much in social media for this stuff. I know I should. You guys are out here killing it though. So
Willard Brothers, huh?
The Willard Brothers Instagram. It's a great follow, especially for woodworking.
Got it. Will do.
Nice.
Yeah.
I have one more question for you. Where do you find your customers at for home remodeling and things like that?
My other brother, not the one running the Instagram page, he has pretty close relationships with local architects, one in particular around Princeton. So he tends to do a lot of architecturally designed work. Some of it, people are interested in what we do. Our thing is probably some energy efficiency, resilience. In-house HVAC is novel. So word gets out. Our town is small. Princeton, this area, it's not a big area. So there's only so many people in our market who are prepared to do, say, larger remodels. We could do a much better job.
Did we get the website for that?
I can post it.
Do you guys have a website for your company?
Oh, our website's horrible. I forget. Our website's defunct.
Okay. I guess we better not post that.
Yeah, exactly. We got some work to do on the website. But the Willard Brothers, I mean, we're mostly there on Willard Brothers Instagram.
Super. Thank you for being open to this, Jesse. It was really enlightening, refreshing. You got a lot of energy. You have a really great perspective. And I hope it gets some gears turning in the minds of our listeners.
Thanks, you guys. I really appreciate you having me on. This was really fun.
Good. Cool. Thanks again, and we appreciate you listening to us here at the Building HVAC Signs Podcast. To learn more, and especially today from Jesse Smith, on the topic of lies, damn lies, and manometer readings. I also host the Res Talk Podcast, where you can learn more about the rapidly expanding world of home energy ratings and outside and peripheral topics. After listening, if you like what you heard today and not subscribed to the podcast, please consider doing so. You can follow us on Facebook by typing Building HVAC Science into the Facebook search bar. If any questions at all or wish to suggest a topic or reach out to us, you can contact us at marketing@truetechtools.com, truetechtools.com. Some of the topics we discuss require technical training for proper interpretation or safe execution. If you're a trained pro, then you can go right ahead. If you're not, please consult with and hire a trained pro. The Building HVAC Science Podcast is a production of True Tech Tools Limited. And full disclosure, I'm a co-owner of True Tech. The opinions voiced are those of my guests, my co-host, or myself, depending on who is speaking, of course. If you're in the market for any of the tools or test instruments mentioned in the podcast, or you just want to browse and see what we have at truetechtools.com, that's truetechtools.com, you can use the offer code HVACBS for a nice discount. Thank you for listening to us here at the Building HVAC Science, and until next time, take care. Bye-bye.